This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
In 2011, writer, journalist, and author Mary Elizabeth Williams was diagnosed with metastatic cancer. She was eligible to participate in a clinical trial for one of the world's first innovative immunotherapies. During this process, one hospital researcher introduced Williams to another as, quote, the tumor, unquote. 12 weeks later, she showed a complete response. Williams shared this journey through her nonfiction book, A Series of Catastrophes and Miracles, which received the 2020 Walter C. Alvarez Award from the American Medical Writers Association to honor excellence in communicating healthcare developments and concepts to the public. She is currently studying for her certification in narrative medicine at Columbia University. And in June 2020, Mary Elizabeth Williams will deliver the keynote address at the DIA Virtual Global Annual Meeting, an address that she has titled Confessions of a Human Subject, Can We Put the Humanity in Scientific Study? I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Today, I welcome Mary Elizabeth, who joins us to share why and how she believes that she can use her own clinical trial experience to benefit other patients. Mary Elizabeth, thank you for joining us today and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Just to get us started, would you perhaps describe briefly your journey as a participant in a groundbreaking clinical trial?
Thank you. I was initially diagnosed with melanoma in 2010. I had surgery. I moved on with my life. I thought of myself as a quote-unquote survivor. And then a year later, I was re-diagnosed at stage 4. At that point in time, and even now, metastatic melanoma is a very, very serious diagnosis to receive. And the survival rate is very, very small. Even now, after so many approved drugs have come to market, it is still a very serious diagnosis with a very low survival rate. So I knew that.
In fact, if I may jump in for just a moment, let me just say I just lost a very dear colleague to melanoma just a month ago. And so I realize and agree with you that, in fact, this continues to be a very tragic condition. So sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to make that comment.
I am so sorry for your loss, and my condolences to you and to all of your colleagues for losing someone that you worked with and cared about. I'm so sorry. Yeah, the quest for better treatment continues, and the quest for higher survival rates definitely continues 9 years later. So because I was very fortunate to be a patient at Memorial Sloan Kettering, my oncologist referred me to the immunotherapy team there at a point in my life where I really didn't even know what immunotherapy was. And 9 years later, a lot of people still don't. And I met with Dr. Jed Walchuk, who is an extraordinary immunotherapist and also just an extraordinary doctor and person. And we began that day a conversation and a collaboration. And I passed through the series of hurdles that it took to enroll in this clinical trial. I understood that because of a lot of advantages that I have in terms of my geographic location, the flexibility of my career, the flexibility of my family and childcare situation, and otherwise very good health, I was eligible to enroll in a phase 1 clinical trial. I had to get an education on what clinical trials really are, what they mean, what the risks are, what the potential benefits are. I started this trial, and 12 weeks later, I presented no evidence of disease. I was extremely lucky. I really won the Powerball in so many ways, and I know that I had a series of green lights every step of the way. And even with all of those advantages, at any point along the line, it could have gone very differently. And now knowing what I know about the process and knowing what I know about what clinical trials look for people who don't have all of my privileges and don't have all of my advantages, I really feel it is important to shake up the system and make it more accessible to more people.
Well, firstly, let me congratulate you on the successful outcome of your participation in this trial, first and foremost. But secondly, do I gather that prior to participating in this trial, your knowledge of clinical trials as an opportunity was very limited, possibly nil?
Extremely limited. My understanding of clinical trials was what I think many people is that I had this concept of what it meant to be randomized. Initially, when my oncologist suggested a clinical trial, assumed that it was a last resort, that she was basically telling me that there was no other course of treatment for me, that there was no other hope. It was a really demoralizing thing when she first broached the subject. And I also did not understand that being a participant in a clinical trial means that you do still get a standard of care. I really went into it with the fear of being experimented on, being just a lab rat, and potentially not receiving any treatment at all. I didn't understand that that is not the way that most trials are conducted. I certainly didn't understand all of the safety protocols around it, which is not to say that there isn't great risk, but I certainly needed an education, and I think most of us do. Unfortunately, the time that most of us learn about clinical trials as patients is when we have to. And it would be so different for all of us if we had a language around clinical trials and an understanding of clinical trials before we need it. That is a big change that needs to happen. We're seeing that borne out right now at this moment in medical history.
Yes, we certainly do. I take it you were able to overcome the fears that you mentioned sufficiently to be willing to participate.
I mean, again, that comes down to communication. I had an amazing team at Memorial Sloan Kettering at that time. The immunotherapy clinic was headed by Dr. James Allison, who went on to win the Nobel Prize for exactly the protocol that I was going to be on, working under the direction of someone like Dr. Jed Wolchuk and the team there, who all really prioritized communication. Well, for the most part, we'll talk about what are the people who didn't, but who really prioritized a collaborative, respectful relationship and who saw me as a human being. Jed Wolchuk often says, I don't treat cancer, I treat people. That approach and that understanding of the process and understanding of disease in context of humanity is the difference between life or death. It certainly is the difference between trust and distrust.
How did you feel about being referred to as the tumor? What was that about? And what was your reaction to that?
It's funny to me because now this guy is so notorious, I feel like, in my lore. And I was actually at an event last fall, and I was seated directly opposite him, and I hadn't seen him in many years. And I thought, oh, he has no idea who I am. I'm just someone who walked into his office many years ago, but he is in many ways the antagonist of my story. There was a time very early in the process when I was trying to get into the trial, and the cancer had moved into my lungs, and it had also moved into my subcutaneous tissue. And the tumor was painful. The one under my skin particularly was in a spot that was very uncomfortable and painful. And I had discussed with my oncologist about whether or not I could have that removed surgically and what we were going to be doing moving forward in the overall course of my treatment. One day, my regular doctor could not come in to see me. And instead, this stranger walked in with a bunch of his fellows. And before he even looked at me, looked at his younger colleagues and said, oh, this is the tumor that I was telling you about. And then proceeded to basically show off the tumor without really addressing me as a human with thoughts and ideas and feelings and anxieties and fears. And when I discussed the tumor, the one in particular that he was looking at that was visible to the naked eye, I said that my doctor and I had been talking about a surgical option, and he said, oh, well, no, you can't do that. You can't do that and participate in the trial. We need that tumor. And it was such a disrespectful way of answering someone who was really scared that she was going to die and leave her children without a mother. So I walked out of that room, and I said to the person behind the desk, I don't want to see this person again. I am not to work with this person. He is not to touch me. And that was the last time I saw him until 8 years later when I was seated opposite him at a dinner party. I'm lucky because part of my job is being somewhat confrontational and being able to feel confident exerting my authority as a patient. A lot of people don't have that. A lot of people don't have the agency that I do. And I am aware of that. I am aware that I had the privilege of saying, I don't want to work with this person. This person is not going to be part of my treatment plan. A lot of people, for a variety of reasons, don't think they can and also just really can't because their options are so much more limited than mine were. it was a luxury to be able to say, I choose someone different. I choose to work with a different team. A lot of people never have anywhere near that kind of opportunity. And that is really unfortunate, because if that person had been the primary researcher on my trial, I would not have done the trial. And if I had not done the trial, I would not be here talking to you right now, unquestionably.
So on that occasion, perhaps you felt objectified, but you were not intimidated. In fact, as you described it, you sort of pushed back and said, well, this is what I want to do, and that is not what I want to do. And you took it from there. You took ownership of your future.
That is not something that we as patients are encouraged to do. That is not something we are trained to do. We are not often given the opportunity to ask follow-up questions. We are not often given the opportunity to say, is this the person you would want to work with? How are things going? How were you treated today? That doesn't happen. That is very uncommon. And some of that is, again, circumstantial based on the limitations of options. But I think a lot of it is also the doctor is the be-all, end-all authority. And we are not seen as collaborators in our own health and in our own healthcare system. And I think that that is a big part of why patients wind up turning, unfortunately, to very dangerous and untried methods, because there is a sense that there is more control and more agency thinking outside the medical system. And that is not a failure of patients who are taken in by these dubious potential treatments. It's really a failure of a system that doesn't respect us.
Let's drill a little deeper into your clinical trial experience. And I'd like to ask you, what aspects did you find appealing, if I may ask, use that word? And which aspects were particularly taxing or burdensome or even annoying? And I know you've gone there already in the last few minutes, but perhaps you could cover both aspects.
The number one most appealing thing about the clinical trial was the not dying, the possibility of getting to live. I was re-diagnosed at the beginning of the school year, and it was very clear in my mind that I wanted very much to be around for the end of it for my children. And I knew at that point in medical history that most people with my diagnosis live about 7 months. So the odds were not in my favor. So the thought of doing conventional treatment and palliative care was not probably going to work. The potential of something that seemed very promising in lab studies was my best option. And I'm fortunate to have a friend who is a researcher in a different company in California. And I talked to him, and he gave me some solid advice sort of from the inside of that world and said, if I were you, I would do it. And if I were you, I would stick with it as much as possible. I think that this is your best opportunity. So that was the big draw, getting to live. Secondarily, working with people who I trusted and who I felt saw me as a human being. And then on the other side of it, it's not easy. It is not easy being in a trial, especially a phase 1. I was one of the first 8. I was in the first cohort of a phase 1. It was very intense. A lot of it felt to me like flying by the seat of my pants. I knew that obviously my medical team knew what they were doing, but it is also unproven ground when you're part of really first in human trials. I did get a rash. I did have at one point a minor adverse event and got a very high fever that fortunately went away and, was probably indicative of my immune system kicking in the way it was supposed to. It was also extremely time consuming. I had to work all of my parenting and all of my working around blood draws and fatigue and dizziness. I was really lucky I did not get some of the more gruesome side effects that I suspect many people who are listening to me know can come with immunotherapy. But I also had to balance all of it within doing all of the regular demands of my life. A couple of months ago, I was doing an event and the person who introduced me said, and then after 2 years in a clinical trial, she returned to work and parenting. And I just thought, do you think I went away? There's a phrase that gets used in narrative medicine, and it's the land of the sick. The idea that sickness takes place sort of off stage from the rest of life, and that somehow sickness is isolated from the day-to-day. And again, as we are seeing borne out very much right now, know the experience of illness and the experience of care and the experience of medicine all takes place right there in the thick of it. And I was still expected to do everything basically that I had to do in my life and be part of a trial where I was sometimes going every single week, sometimes multiple times a week, to a neighborhood that I was fortunate I could get to. I know many people who participate in clinical trials have a much, much more inconvenient road, but it was hard. The time consumption and the physically draining aspects of it while doing everything else, I can't overstate how challenging that is. And I say that as someone who had truly fairly minimal physical side effects, who had a pretty good experience, who ran a marathon while she was in treatment. I do like to brag about that. Yes, thank you. But to make the point that I wasn't super sick in a way that some people get in clinical trials, and yet it was still very challenging. And I think that that speaks to understanding in the clinical process that patients are humans who have lives and whose lives take place outside of that clinic.
So the clinical trial was really interwoven with all of the other aspects of your life. As you said, it wasn't separate. It was really embedded in it. One of the expressions in heavy use these days is patient engagement in clinical research and in their own care. So I'd like to ask you, to what extent did you feel that the system asked you on a regular basis, how can we make this better for you? How can we make it more convenient? How can we change it and adapt to your needs as a patient in a clinical trial?
The system, no. The system really has a very long way to go. The individuals I worked with, my nurses, my doctors, the people who I saw in the day-to-day engaged with me in a way that I'm extremely grateful for. And they are grateful to me. I want to point that out, that my feedback as a patient, as a reporter, as a historian of what was going on in the clinical trial was seen as valuable, had value, had merit. It wasn't just a passive experience of me receiving treatment and then moving on from there. I was a participant in something new and different, and I had responsibilities. If you are a patient in a clinical trial, you are responsible. You should feel that it is your job to observe and report. And as a reporter, that comes fairly naturally to me, but it should be part of the process for everyone. And I don't think that clinical trials are necessarily set up for that kind of engagement. And part of that is not just because patients aren't encouraged, but because doctors aren't trained to, because medical staff, clinicians aren't trained to think that way. We don't think of patients that way, and we don't design clinical trials that way from the top down. When you look at the way that protocols are written and scheduled, and you look at what a consent form looks like, I mean, consent forms are just impossible. They are not written for patients. They are not written in language that is frank and simple and engaging. They are not written in a way that encourages asking questions. There are certainly not different platforms offered to patients, so that maybe if you would feel more comfortable listening to the material on your consent form or having it spoken to you conversationally or doing some sort of role play ahead of time so you can practice asking your questions, very little of that happens. And that is why when you look at the disparity between the number of clinical trials that are out there and the tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of eligible patients who participate in them, and the tinier, even tinier number of patients who are people of color, it's staggering. And that is not a failure of science. That's a failure of communication. The good news is that should be fixable.
We're now in a time, thanks to the crisis, the pandemic, that where we see acceleration of the implementation of innovations in clinical trials, such as virtual visits, remote monitoring, remote data capture, decentralized clinical trials. So I think this really is a time for disruptive innovation, where all the stakeholders are looking for ways to do things differently because the old way does not work. So in this particular space, what do you think we can learn about how we can improve the patient experience in clinical trials after this has all passed and we get to a new normal? You've touched on a few, but what are some ways that we can really improve the experience of the patient who agrees voluntarily to participate in a clinical trial?
you nailed it when you said it's very clear that a lot of the old ways just don't work, or they worked well enough, but there are lives at stake, and there is also so much money being wasted on research that never gets to the trial stage, that never progresses then beyond the trial stage because of recruitment and retention problems. It should be glaringly obvious that that doesn't work. This trial vividly shows the need for more expansive clinical trial parameters. It certainly shows that if we are creating protocols for patients who, like me, are otherwise perfectly healthy and have no comorbidities, we're not in any way serving the people who are the most vulnerable. Look at who is most directly impacted by this virus. It's people who have pre-existing conditions, and yet people with pre-existing conditions are routinely shut out of the clinical trial process. We look at all of the barriers to participation, like you were talking about telemedicine. All of these things are things we can be doing. All of the collaboration that has always been possible is now being drawn on in new ways. And I am hopeful that the old models that just were serviceable enough are going to be replaced with ones that are truly patient-centric and truly recognize the need to just change how we talk to patients, how we collaborate with patients, that recognize the value of the patient population as their own reporters and historians. We need that kind of back and forth. Healthcare should not be a passive experience at all. If something is not working and it's not convenient for patients, or it's not understandable for patients, then what's broken isn't the patient.
In recent years, a lot of lip service has been paid to the notion of listening to the voice of the patient. And you also commented that doctors are not necessarily trained to listen to patients. What do you think should be done to help doctors be more willing to listen to the voice of patients, whether in care or in clinical trials?
There's a lot that can be done. I'm seeing that more now in the way that medical training is being conducted. Certainly looking at the systems in which you're going to be working is really important. There is a hospital system here in New York City that really takes community health very seriously and makes sure that every person who is a doctor or nurse on the staff is equipped to deal with the communities in which they are going to be working, and really strives to serve the patient population specific to the neighborhoods in which those facilities are located. So that's more boots on the ground training when you're actually at a facility, but also there is a lot that is being done in terms of seeing patient participation not as a luxury that is tacked on at the very end of the process, but is really necessary at the beginning of it, whether it is in the research field, where a lot of researchers don't think, well, why should we know how to talk to patients? And it's like it's a chain of communication. We have to know every single step of the way. There's a lot that is being done really well in terms of patient navigator work. But we also have to be very, very careful. I am aware that I am someone who is a professional communicator, and it's not hard for me to state what I want, and it's not hard for me to push back when I feel I'm not being heard. But there has to be much, much deeper engagement from patients who don't look like me. And I sometimes bristle when I'm called an advocate, because I feel like a lot of the advocacy world is taken up with people who look a lot like me. In healthcare, we need people who don't look like me, who don't sound like me, who have challenges that are extraordinarily different from mine. And that is an active process. It's got to be top down and bottom up on all sides.
Every story that needs to be told needs to have somebody who listens to it. So I'd like to ask you about your field. What is narrative medicine?
Narrative medicine is still a fairly new discipline. There are a lot of different ways of describing it, but the way that I usually do is bringing the skills and critical thinking and empathy that we develop through humanities and humanities-based education to the field and the practice of medicine. That's what I'm trying to do. Most of the people who are in my program come from a medical background, come from the healthcare field. There aren't too many of us who are from the other side of it. But I think where we try to meet in the middle is understanding how this field that, frankly, as a parent, I can see has been widely dismissed and neglected and treated as an afterthought actually is critical to the practice of care and medicine. The way that you understand and listen, or the way that you look at a painting, or the way that you listen to a song, and the way that you can then talk about it with other people and interpret it differently, those are the skills that foundationally can be applied to listening to a patient, to interpreting their information, to being able to say, maybe I'm not understanding this right. Maybe you're telling me something different. All of the just critical listening, that's, I think, what it really boils down to, is assessing not just from data, but from really all these other clues. Several months ago, I was giving a talk at an organization. One of the things they do is they write these consent documents. And one of the people there, who could not have been lovelier or more helpful, said to me, I really hear what you're saying about the consent process and how flawed it is. And I want you to know, I really take that seriously. So when I write these consent forms, I run them through Microsoft Word to make sure that they're written at an eighth grade level. And I thought, oh, no, that's not how it's done. You don't run it through a machine and have the machine tell you if a human being can read it. I said, have you actually handed one of those to an eighth grader and had an eighth grader read it? We can look at all the data, and I think we can be very seduced by numbers, and we can be seduced by data and everything that it can do. And it is such an exciting time right now in terms of information and what we can do in terms of analysis. But recently I heard this, and it really stuck with me, that we need to think of communication and humanity as innovative and radical. That if we give those skills the same regard that we give all of the maybe sexier aspects of medicine right now, we can really change things in a very dramatic way.
Is the core of narrative medicine basically storytelling? I apologize if I am oversimplifying, but is storytelling at the core?
I don't want to speak for narrative medicine or the people who practice it in different ways, but that is what I would say. It's storytelling and story listening and radical listening. That's how I am interpreting it, and that's what I'm trying to do with it, is looking at the ways that we talk to each other and listen to each other and just communication. We can look at all the science, and that is hugely important. But if we are not interpreting it in a way that makes sense for patients, and if we are not hearing a patient say, well, but here's why I can't get to the clinic, or here's why I'm not taking my medicine, and here's what I'm scared of. If we can't offer that humanity, that empathy, that reassurance, then it's all for naught. And as you said, you know, when you look at what's going on right now and you see doctors who can't touch their patients, who can't even really have their patients read their facial expressions because they're all hidden behind so much protective gear, the need for effective communication and subtle communication is more important than ever. Really, it comes down again to life or death. And even in life or death, what can you do to make a patient feel reassured and safe?
Can narrative medicine writers and other writers help improve the patient experience generally and in clinical trials in particular?
I hope that more people who are in the medical profession take the time to not necessarily enroll in a full course, but to work within the framework and the tools that narrative medicine provides and really think about, how can I use my own critical reasoning, or how can I maybe do a writing workshop, look at a painting or listen to a piece of music and think about my approach to that and how I can then creatively apply that. I don't think it's an accident that Dr. James Allison and my Dr. Jed Wolchuk are musicians. They are musicians as well as clinicians. And I definitely feel always that they are bringing that sense of music gives us what narrative gives us, which is hearing the story in a different way, seeing the story in a different way, interpreting information in a different way that uses different parts of our brains. That is just so, so important, because if we have our noses to the grindstone all the time and we're only looking at numbers, we're just simply not using all of our resources and all of our brains. And in terms of what I hope moves forward for clinicians and patients alike, it's so clear that we need to develop our listening skills and our communication skills and develop better respect and better ways of saying, I want to look at things from different sides. In dialectical behavioral therapy, we say everyone is doing their best and everyone can do better. My hope is that we rise to that challenge every single day.
That's a wonderful message to close our conversation with, Mary Elizabeth Williams. I really want to thank you for your time, your insights, and your willingness to share your experience in your clinical trial, which again, wonderfully successful for you and your family. And again, congratulations on that wonderful outcome. Thank you.
I cannot speak for the entire patient population, but I can speak for myself and say that it means so much when people from your side of healthcare wants to listen and want to pay attention and want to make it better for patients, because we're all patients at one time or another, and we all just want to be treated like we're humans.
We are all doing our best and we can do better, right? As you said.
Exactly. Thank you.
For the AIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.